Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you're listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Talk Radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media Project. You can join our team by going to www.coffeepartyusa.com and volunteer to be the media. Well, here we are, day two post State of the Union address. Big sigh. Today on Lunch with Loudon, we're interested in a conversation about last Tuesday's State of the Union address, a real conversation. As my daughter, who's a hairstylist, would say, well, there were highlights and there were lowlights. Sorry if you don't get the joke, but those of you who do will appreciate it. Debbie Lynn and I want this to be an unplugged conversation. That means we're asking ourselves and each of you to stay as far away from talking points as possible and try to express our insights and our questions, our thoughts, our concerns in ways that don't cry out for a partisan response. I think we've sort of established on this show many times that it's just too Pavlovian, you know, when the code words get used. What do you think about that one, Debbie Lynn? Are we ready for a code word-free broadcast today?
Absolutely.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks for being here. There are other people who have said they're calling in, and they remain anonymous until they actually show, but I'm looking. So here's some background. Both Debbie Lynn and I are registered voters. We're rabid voters, we vote, who do not belong to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. We also believe that there's plenty to be gained by listening to people who aren't necessarily registered the same way we are. You know, that first you're an American citizen, then you're a voter, right? And let's face it, the address that we just heard was from a president who appears to be losing popularity and made to the least liked Congress in history, as far as I can tell. Now, I'm counting on the historians out there in the Lunch with Loudon Brain Trust to correct me if those things aren't true. But I think we really actually all tuned into the address expecting to listen to the Titanic sink or something. Not a lot of optimism has been expressed before or after on some of our Facebook pages. But that said, the State of the Union is still State of the Union. And as citizens, we have a right to respond with comments and questions, and we should be discussing this very important moment every year. We hope you'll chime in. Do that by calling 646-929-2495 and press the 1 to put yourself in the host queue. Debbie Lynn is on guard for ones in the queue. She's also watching chat. And so if you're streaming today, you're certainly welcome to make your comments there, and Debbie Lynn will bring them in. So let's see. Let's start. Here's a place to begin. What was said with which you agree? What was said with which you do not agree? What was not said that you wanted to hear? And that goes for either in the address or in the many, many rebuttals to the address. And then the other thing I'd love to hear, if you'd like to share, is was there a moment for you, like an aha moment or an oh darn moment? I had two of those, and I'm sure I'll get a chance to share those with you. But for now, I'm going to start with you, Debbie Lynn, because you are my ever-faithful co-pilot and all-around nice person and always a great addition to this conversation. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. And just real quick, the chat room is not working right now, so I'll keep working on that in the background, trying to get it to work. But I had some things posted in there, but I couldn't see anything else that they were posting. So just to let everybody get a heads up that I'll do what I can to get that working again.
I did watch
the State of the Union live, and I watched the Congresswoman from Washington's rebuttal speech. And then I read the speeches from the Tea Party Express. I did not read Rand Paul's, and I forget who the other guy was. But the
other
ones
one was in Spanish.
It was a Spanish woman, then a Cuban woman from Florida. But the themes were very similar, actually, from the president and to the two that I read. And it was largely about helping the middle class, growing jobs, doing something about the growing inequality in our country, taking care of our troops, supporting families, being fiscally responsible. These are all common themes throughout all of the speeches. Also in common was a stated desire to work together and a pointed accusation towards the other side of not working together and it being all your way or the highway, or their way or the highway. And so it actually sounded like here we have all these things in common that we want to work on, but you're not willing to compromise, so we're not going to talk to you, even though we agree we have all these things in common. And I couldn't help but think about the similarities to the Middle East conflict, especially between Israel and Palestine, and to some of these other, what's happening in Africa. And it's kind of like, within our own country now need to, start using shuttle diplomacy to say, okay, all right, we got the administration to agree to this, and then you go to the Republicans in Congress and you go, okay, well, we got the Republicans to agree, and maybe if they do this already, to go back and forth, because it's simply the tone and the contempt with which they have for one another that's actually keeping any progress from being made. Because we agree on the issues. But the code words, as you were talking about earlier, add to this way that that keeps us apart, because it signals disrespect for the other side.
Well, I have to tell you that in everything I've read, everything I listened to, the comments, I even went back, I had TiVo'd the speech and went back and looked at it several times. And it is kind of amazing how we can sort of be saying the same thing and not talking to each other. And I was particularly agitated by Kathy McMorris Rogers' response. She's up here from the Pacific Northwest. We all know who she is. She's no stranger to us. But, I have been, I can't even tell, I was going to say, how long have I been a quote-unquote feminist? Probably as long as I figured out that there needed to be such a thing. But I tell you, I am the angry grandmother who can't believe we're defending women's rights again. And then a woman from my own neck of the woods basically used a code word. And she talked about choice, but she was talking about the choice to choose your insurance company, not about access to care. And I just thought that was so disingenuous. And so I don't know, it wouldn't almost matter to me which side of that conversation you were on. It was an inauthentic thing to say, to use a code word that everyone knows is a code word, and to use it in such a blatantly inappropriate or misleading, that's the word I'm looking for, way. Now, that said, I spent a lot of time reviewing the Tea Party response. And I have to tell you, I had to watch it twice, and I had to watch it twice because 75% of what was said, I mean, the Tea Party response did a better job of saying the things I wanted to hear that I didn't hear on the address, meaning topic-wise. They used terms like crony capitalism. They used terms like, the disparity between the wealthy and the rest of us. And, on and on, all these words that are concepts, rather, that certainly this broadcast has been discussing for a couple of years now, and certainly has been within, between you and me, gentlemen. But then what was the unsaid was the disturbing part there. It was like there were supposedly so the issues were well-defined, but the solutions were nebulous. And the solutions kind of spoke to, let's get rid of this government, but what are we replacing it with? And it just sounded like, well, the UNCED was this other government. And then, of course, all the prime movers that were discussed in that one were prime movers who tend to believe that we need a more biblically driven constitution. And that's a very interesting point. And if there are people out there who would like to speak to that, this is a well-done speech. Our number is 646-929-2495. Any moments, other moments for you?
The well, we kind of talked about what was said and what was not said. I mean, the missing, there was three really big missing pieces for me. One of them was the talking about surveillance of U.S. citizens and the whole NSA debacle.
Yes.
I actually went back this morning as I was rereading the State of the Union this morning, and there's a one sentence about making sure that we're not that the surveillance is not invading the privacy of ordinary citizens, and it's following, it's the sentence is immediately following his sentence about the prudent use of drones. And it was probably like,
prudent.
I was so shocked about the prudent use of drones sentence that I didn't even hear the next sentence after that. But that was his one little, you know, the president's one little sentence about so that was missing for me. If there's anything substantial about the NSA or surveillance. The other thing that was missing for me was anything about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I had somebody else Facebook message me on that and say, well, he mentioned something about trading with China early in the speech, and I kind of went, oh, it was so obscure, I totally missed that one too. But the rest of it, I pretty much liked. I was glad that there was still a commitment to closing Gitmo. There's still a commitment to immigration reform. There's still a commitment to women. You know, a lot of other things in there that I actually liked. But those were some big missing pieces for me.
Yes, yes. And Tudor Magic chimes in from the chat room that, that he put the Congress on notice, and I thought to myself, hadn't you already been put on notice? I mean, I don't know how many more ways cyber citizens have been trying to put the president on notice about a few things, the NSA and TPP specifically, and certainly others. But and I'll get back to what Tudor Magic said in a minute, but really, like, on notice about these things. By the way, you may have seen, some of you who follow any of follow us on Facebook, we actually found the single most appropriate use for a drone the other day when a camera on a drone was used to capture big water on the north shore of Oahu. And
yes.
It was like, you know, because big water is way out there, and the drone flew overhead and got some of the most amazing shots ever. And so if there's ever the question, is there an appropriate use for a drone, I hope you'll look on Facebook and find amazing surf footage there. So they're missing.
So
there was a lot missing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go
yep.
ahead.
Eric, it looks like he's ready to go. If you want to call in, Eric, and I'm still trying to get my chat room ready, so I'm glad that you can see it. Thanks, Janine.
Yeah, I can see it, so I'll be watching it. Okay, so here I come. I'm going to open Eric Beiler's mic. Eric, welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Thank you, Janine. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us today. So we are obviously talking about the State of the Union address and ways in which we can sort of discuss this in an unplugged or talking point or code-free way. And I bet you have something to say about that.
Well, my feeling about the State of the Union was that it was appropriately couched in a way that would appeal to Republicans, at least the more John Boehner type of Republicans, the more moderate type of Republicans. And I went into it thinking that there was going to be a lot of sort of election season type of language to kind of blame the Republicans for the obstruction and the gridlock and sort of, you know, say I'm going to do some things on my own without you and the American people are with me. I really expected there to be a lot of emphasis on polls that show that the things that we aren't doing because of that obstructionism are things that are very popular. The kind of stuff that you actually hear more from Republicans when they say, we are the American people, and the American people don't want Obamacare, that kind of stuff. I expected Obama to sort of do that kind of thing just based on the pre-speech chatter. And then he really didn't. The only thing that I thought that Republicans might be upset with was that he stood firm on the Affordable Care Act. But other than that, immigration is something where I think the majority of Republicans are with him. There are people on the far right who, for whatever reason, don't buy the economic argument, or the economic and fiscal viability of our country is less important than something else. But most of the issues that he brought up are things that he can find agreement across the aisle. And I think that he probably thought, rather than creating another year of big fights with the speech, maybe I can lay the groundwork for some successes that can help both parties show the American people that they are interested in governing as well as electioneering.
Well, I think you're right, Eric. I hadn't really thought of it in terms of there wasn't political posturing in the sense of this is an election year and this is what, this is sort of a partisan approach to that. That you're right, it wasn't there. And I think the closest he came to sort of saying, you know, everybody thinks we're a bunch of ne'er-do-wells, and you're more of a ne'er-do-well than I am. You know, he just said, America won't stand still, and neither will I. That was it. And that was just brought up in our chat room, that this was sort of an amazingly gentle throwing down of the glove, you know, but saying, let's do this, you know, let's do this. And I admired that, actually.
So, one of the things that I want to just ask you guys about then is, I have a lot of conservative friends that are on my Facebook page, and some of the comments that I was getting back last night, the language that was being used was imperial dictator. He's declaring himself an imperial dictator. He's not going to be following the Constitution. He can't do things without Congress. And so I'm just wondering, how are we going to, if we have both sides declaring the other person as the other body as the obstructionist, how do we move forward? What do we, the people, actually do?
Right, right. And Eric, did you see any of those comments challenging the virtue of, or the legality of executive orders? And I mean, I think that the imperial dictator thing was way beyond what was actually said in the speech.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to share that I was on site at an EPA research and development lab during the Reagan administration. And I promise you, I know the power of an executive order. And even if it's just an executive order, he talked about raising the minimum wage on government contracts to $10.10 an hour. And when you consider all government employees, when you consider their seasonal employees, their full-time employees, their part-time employees, and then all the contractors with government or within government contracting standards are applied in the states, that's a lot of people being impacted just by doing what he can do as employer in chief. And so never underestimate what can change by merely changing first yourself. when who you are is the guy who sits in the Oval Office. Reagan used them a lot, and they were hugely effective. So you have any thoughts on that one, Eric?
Well, yeah, I mean, having enough of a appreciation for recent American history is a good way to respond to the accusation that there are more executive orders with President Obama than recent presidents, which is not true.
No.
The thing about this is an imperial president, I mean, that was something that's been, they've been working on that for a long time. Just one of the attack lines. And then, you know, just like my expectation was that it would be more of an election speech, you know, a stump speech than it turned out to be, it seems like the people who are sort of in that that isolated chamber of objection to the recent presidential elections, they expected there to be a kind of a speech that would get them really upset. And so the whole outrage body of work was actually, a lot of it was developed before the speech. And what I would prefer to see
yes.
from those people is, like me, watch the speech, and then if it's different from what you expected, then adjust your critique to what you saw and heard. And as far as, you know, people who can't do that, well, all we can do is try to set an example and try to give more voice to people who can and do what we can to minimize the damage done by people who just won't.
Well, I actually think that makes a lot of sense, because I think the way you described the speech or the expectations of speech and what I read in the media and in the blogosphere anticipating the speech, these kinds of reactions that Debbie Lynn is describing really might have been more appropriate if it had actually happened. But the truth be told, you're correct. It didn't happen. And I think some people were left a little deflated because there weren't a lot of fighting words. You know what I mean? And so I think that that's a brilliant observation that you made. And I would be the first to say, if you've already written your blog before the speech, you might want to reconsider it before you posted it, you know, when it didn't turn out, you know, not that I've ever done that. You know, I'm sure it's a pitfall that more than one blogger has fallen into. So I think you're right about that. So
yeah, there may be another reason.
Go ahead.
Well, there might be another reason why we were all fooled, and that is that in recent times, the only kind of language being formulated about things like inequality or the Wall Street lawlessness or whatever was coming from the left. It was coming from Occupy Wall Street, or it was, you know, coming from people who are a lot more partisan than the president. And so his decision to really take that on was, I saw, you know, a number of people on the web saying they were disappointed that it wasn't as forceful, or, you know, it wasn't really indicting people. It wasn't pointing fingers the way that some other language that's emerged and been effective in recent years has. So it just may be that we all were kind of thrown off by the expectation that there was only really one way to talk about the problems that our country faces. But the president showed that there is a way to say, look, if women aren't getting a fair shake, if immigrants aren't getting a fair shake, if gays and lesbians aren't getting a fair shake, if people who are working full-time can't earn enough money to feed themselves or their families, it's not just bad for those people, but it's bad for all of us, and we need to start thinking about it that way.
Oh, exactly, exactly. As a matter of fact, I had two, you know, moments in the speech, and one of them was, you know, obviously, when women succeed, America succeeds, and That didn't make it to the top five tweets, and that didn't make it to the five things to take away from the speech, but it rang true with me. And so you're right. There was a lot of curious. One place, of course, I was looking for. Oh, let me go back to one thing. I've collected all kinds of critiques, responses to, and statements about the State of the Union Address. And if you want to see that collection, you can go to the Lunch with Loudon Facebook page, and you'll see a dozen or so of these different responses, including the official responses, the unofficial responses, and then, of course, some articles and blogs. And so it is interesting that, frankly, some of the most articulate criticism of the speech does come from the progressive side of the spectrum. And I think that's important to know. So the other thing that I really focused on, or it took my breath away, is I kept waiting for money in politics, money in politics. What are you going to say about money in politics? And the one quote I got was, it should be the power of our vote, not the size of our bank accounts, that drives our democracy. And, of course, the context for that statement was in terms of voting rights, you know, citizens' ability to vote. And I was very glad that he spoke to that. And, of course, your work down in North Carolina, Eric, certainly points to the need to have the voting conversation sort of transcend that kind of political, you know, some other more harsh political rhetoric, but at least they acknowledge the coffee party belief that the currency mm-hmm. of this democracy should be votes and not money. And I was wondering if, especially given all your work with Story of America, if there's how you were received the comments on voting.
Well, I'm glad it was mentioned. You know, he mentioned it on election eve, and his acceptance speech as well about the long lines at the polls. I guess you could say I'm concerned, but it's a little bit more than that. I'm a little frustrated with the willingness that politicians have, especially at the state level, to try to essentially warp the election law body of election law, in order to insulate themselves from changing demographics. So a lot of problems with that. One of them is the historical, the echoes, painful, horrific echoes of other times in our history where we've
yeah.
tried to warp election laws in order to protect against demographic changes, emancipation being the most obvious and most horrific. Chinese American immigrants were not only excluded from voting, but excluded from citizenship for fear that they might achieve some sort of political representation if they were not excluded. In Pennsylvania in 1820, when a lot of German immigrants were arriving, they concocted a thing called voter registration, which we had never had before. And in order to register to vote, in order to vote, you had to register, not just once, but every time you voted, you had to remember to register a few months before the election. But this was only true where the German immigrants lived. It wasn't true of other parts of the state, of Pennsylvania. And, of course, in New York, as Jewish immigrants arrived, they came up with the voter registration trick as well. And they said, yes, you can register to vote, and everyone's welcome to register to vote. It applies equally to everyone, but you can only register to vote on the Jewish Sabbath. On Saturday.
Now, well, you know, this sounds like the trick when I first moved to California, and there was a voter registration table outside of a grocery store or something, and, you know, and I've been in town for 2 weeks or something. I'm like, oh, yeah, I need to register to vote because the election's coming up and stuff, and they're like, okay, you know, and when I didn't check the box that said Republican, they were like, oh, well, you'll have to turn that in yourself. We're only turning in the Republican one.
That's actually against the law in Virginia, because I know someone's in jail for that.
It is everywhere. But that's, yeah, that was what they did 23 years ago.
Wow. Yeah, so, I mean, there's all kinds of that going on. And, you know, in the feature film, there's this interesting conversation that I have with a volunteer precinct, the guy who's in charge of a precinct on election day. And he was completely unprepared when it turned out that there weren't enough machines for the number of people for him, for his precinct, and people had to wait 5 hours to vote this past November 2012.
Yeah.
And I asked him about this, and he's a, you know, long-term government guy. I couldn't get any reading on his politics, and he really believes in the process, and he wanted these people to be able to vote. He did everything he could. You know, he helped make sure they had water and chairs. It was, he basically ran it like it was some sort of disaster relief center so these people could. He did everything he could. But in the conversation that we had, I said, don't you think there's a problem with equal access to the polls? If you have people in one area, which happened to be African-American, waiting 5 hours, and then a few miles away, people can vote in 5 minutes. Like, doesn't that create a problem with access, equal access? And his answer, and maybe if he had thought about it, he might have changed it, but what we show him say in the movie is that it is equal access. It just takes them longer to get there. And the last thing I'll say about that is that there are national organizations, conservative national organizations, that are writing election law for states in order to protect against the influence of demographic shift. They brought these laws that created long lines at the polls to Florida for 2012. And it's a very simple equation. If you cut the number of early voting days,
yes,
then more people are pushed to election day. And it has an influence in the urban areas. It has an influence where people live, where there's more people. And where there are less people, it doesn't affect their voting experience. And so it's a very shrewd way of shaving off the numbers in the areas where the people you don't want to vote live. So they did this for Florida 2012, and they succeeded in creating 7, 8, 9-hour lines in the urban areas like Miami. It didn't quite get the results that they wanted, and it also led to, for the second time in 12 years, Florida being basically the worst example of elections in the United States. And so they moved to repeal those laws, and they put early voting back to where it was in March of 2013. At the same time, the same national organizations, the same shady election lawyers were moving the same approach to North Carolina for 2016. And that's exactly what they did. And they had a guy from Florida who was an election guy, you know, one of the guys who cares about the process. He runs an entire county, a very populous county down in Florida, explain what happened. He said early voting is the thing that saves us from long lines at the polls. When you cut it, you create long lines at the polls. And they went ahead and did it anyway. And, you know, I just watched the whole thing unfold, all the while having people say, well, they're going to have the same number of early votings in the rural white areas as they're going to have the same number of early voting days in the urban areas, and that's fair. And you can't prove that we have any other intention, and maybe that's true. But this, you know, it has frustrated me a lot that there aren't too many people other than that one guy who was on The Daily Show who will acknowledge that this is really just an attempt to insulate the electorate from the population, which to me is kind of anti-democratic.
Right. But, you know, as I was listening to you, Eric, it really came home to me that even in a State of the Union address where the president addressed voting, it really is important to hear the background to which he's speaking, you know. And I think that so it doesn't have to be a lot of words. I think that his position was pretty clear, that people need to be able to vote. And I think that that's a good thing. And I don't know if that's putting people on notice. I don't know. You know, I'm not the POTUS psychic, you know. But I appreciated what he had to say, even if that was the only comment about dollars versus votes, even though we didn't talk about Wall Street reform or tax code reform, you know, so much. I was pleased to hear a position on voting. And
everyone would agree that a speech is only a speech. It's not really policy. And so it's
right.
True, there are things that he could have and should have probably talked about more. But given that it's probably true that the best path to making good policy in the House of Representatives right now is to allow Speaker Boehner to lead his caucus without having a tremendous sort of backlash from the extreme right. So if Obama can somehow sort of hand the ball to Boehner on things like immigration or on restoring the Voting Rights Act without giving his, you know, Boehner's, I guess you could say they have a common enemy in a sense, but without giving the Boehner's headache people in his caucus the ammunition to pressure Boehner to not act or to take actions that are hurtful to our economy. I think it was just sort of a strategic choice that Obama made, and I think it's very practical, and I'm a practical person, so I agree.
As opposed to the other of the five issues that were the takeaway issues for many people, one of them that was, of course, the Affordable Care Act. He can't leave that to the speaker and his caucus. And the climate change statement was interesting to me because certainly I think the whole misinformation campaign or a lot of the narrative about climate change is also funded by, what did you use? The term you used earlier was shady. Shady lawyers and shady funders, you know, background organizations. And so I'm sure that, you know, maybe to me it's no surprise that the climate change question is answered. Let's stop asking it. But I liked that he attempted to put a period at the end of the sentence so that we could move forward because we do have a whole energy future to consider. And I don't know, it was almost like blowing the kickoff whistle or something. Yeah, that's what it felt like to me. And again, something that you're not going to leave to the speaker and his caucus to do for you or with you. It takes some leadership on that one.
Yeah, and on climate change isn't. Oh, go ahead, Debbie Lynn.
Well, I was just going to say he actually had, you know, this whole section on citizenship where he, which is where he put in the part about voting, and gun control, and then this participation, because, and this is where he had the sentence too about, you know, voting should count more than writing a check or something like that. You know, and he was actually kind of calling out us, the American people, saying, you know, you have to participate in order for this country to work. And so that it's not just about all of them in Washington, you know, behind the curtain, so to speak, but it's about what we ask people on our behalf to do in Washington and stand behind and provide cover for. I appreciate, you know, that was one of the things that made it out on my Facebook thread as I was watching things that I liked that I was just putting out was, you know, yeah, it is our country and what do we need to do to tend to it. You know, I know all of us are very active, but how do we inspire others who are maybe not so active?
Well, and again, you have to dovetail that with voting. I mean, if when voting becomes more important than funding elections, then there's some advantage or there's some power to citizenship. I mean, let's face it, what is citizenship in a world where the funders control the governor, those who govern?
Mm-hmm.
So if our elected are elected by us and then supervised or managed by others, then we're sort of in trouble, aren't we? And mm-hmm. That's, you know, so it's an interesting little do loop. when it comes to citizen participation. I mean, Dan Aronson, who the host of Press One for Democracy on Monday nights, he's the first one who will tell you that if everybody who didn't vote in the last election, who was eligible to vote and did not vote, voted, they could change everything. You know, and so there's that power there. And so we see that power being challenged, but also, to me, the missing was, and the other side of the coin is the shady funders who are against voter access, and the shady lawyers that do their bidding. They call them lobbyists. And then I interrupted you earlier, Eric.
No, I think I'm good.
Excellent. So the other person that's been waiting for a little bit is Egberto Willis. Egberto, I'm going to open the mic. This is not intended to be a coffee party board meeting, but I'm very interested in your take on the State of the Union address and on the kind of rhetoric and narrative and conversation that's happened since. And can you let us know, without talking points, your reaction to this speech?
You ever heard the story that you listen to a speech two different ways? You listen to it without sound, and then you listen to it with sound and see if it actually comes across the same? I actually...
Yeah.
Tried that twice, and I went to a watch party and watched it with the sound on, and then I said, let me do that exercise. And when they replayed it on CNN, I did the same thing because I was doing some other work and just went ahead and looked at it. And it was interesting that this time around, his body motion seemed to mimic the rhetoric that he was talking about. And it kind of made me wonder why. And my impression is that the man may feel like he is probably released. I mean, he doesn't have to run an election again. And just maybe, and I've had this discussion with other people, just maybe some of the policies and attempts that some of us would like him to try would actually get done. Unfortunately, while there's a lot of positive that folks have been talking about the speech, I read a little note that Develin had on her. I just came home and it flew into my thread, where she mentioned about what he said about drones and so forth. It wasn't covered. That's true. But one of the, I think the biggest things that weren't covered, that wasn't covered, was that it seems to me that based on his commerce statement, he intends to push the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is something that I think personally I am very against, and a lot of us I think here are against. So it's going to be an interesting scenario to see that while we love a lot of the positive that he displayed, how much pushback we are willing to give. And I can tell you personally, that is, I intend to give a whole lot of pushback on the Trans-Pacific Partnership because I think it's a severe danger to the middle class and the poor.
Yeah, it is scary. And remember, the secret parts, the Ron Wyden, my senator from Oregon, is on the committee that will eventually bring that out of committee and into the daylight, and he can't read all the parts of that agreement yet. And yet, whether it's at 600... lobbyists can. So, yeah, I think it's a question of process as much as it is content. And as we know from things like the Patriot Act, which also has parts, there are parts of the Patriot Act that the clearance required is higher than most people on the committees that review it, so they can't even read it. And so it's just, again, we're talking the process there. Would it stand the light of day? I personally don't think so, but I don't think that's the issue. The issue is, are our elected able to do their job, even if they wanted to? And on this one, it looks like not. He also didn't talk about future energy, which is like one of my favorite sayings, you know, yesterday energy and future energy is how I speak the situation. And he did talk about moving forward, but didn't say, and that, how, you know, didn't talk about how that excludes, as far as I'm concerned, the XL Keystone Pipeline. So
right.
A lot not said, and a lot of very specific criticisms from, again, I don't think you were on the board when I talked about there's like a dozen articles on the Lunch with Loudon Facebook page reacting to the speech. And there is a narrative from some and specifics from others. And the progressive side of the spectrum tends to be a little more intense about the nature of its criticisms. So I think that's even after this broadcast, I think people should take the time to look at the wide range of responses. So did you have any moments? Did you have any aha moments?
Well, I tell you what, I don't know who could not have been touched when, you know, a lot of times we use the military as props, and
yes.
I won't deny that every politician does that. But the fact that he had a personal relationship with the guy before he was hurt, and that
yes.
that person thought that this commander-in-chief meant so much to him that he placed the picture of the commander-in-chief on his bedside while being, you know, while being ill or being dismembered as he was, or hurt, you know, as he was. That was one, I didn't know the story before, I'll confess, but later on when I found out the story that, okay, this young man wasn't a prop, but there was really some sort of a commander-in-chief relationship with this guy here. I mean, I don't know how you couldn't look up there and sort of like, gosh, you know. And then the second part that comes after that is, well, you're really glad that at least these are two promises that are going to be fulfilled, that we're going to be, for all practical purposes, out of Iraq and Iran, because look at what war, look at the consequences of war to some of our youngest, most necessary folks in the country. That young man, think about the life you would have had before having gone to war. So, I mean, when you look at things like that, it was great. Now, when it comes to the economy and so forth, I am sorry. I just think we are sort of in limbo now, and I don't think we can accomplish. I think groups like ours and other groups really are going to have to engage to get something accomplished, because right now the president or the Congress won't ever be able to do anything together. So it is going to be all up on us to sort of force the issue.
Engagement is good.
Yes.
Engagement is good. And I will say that, you know, that I'm a military mom, and my son did two tours in Iraq and came back, and it took him several years to deal with the issues he developed there. So, you know, there's this part of me that's, of course, I adore those who serve. I also have a very realistic view of how they're deployed and how they're treated when they come home. And it was a tender moment to know that somebody he met, you know, it wasn't somebody that a staffer picked out of a card Rolodex, you know.
Right.
But the other thing that really touched me the most was 10 deployments. For heaven's sake, who's going to survive 10 deployments? And how many, you know, didn't come mm-hmm. home after the fourth or the fifth or the sixth or the seventh or the eighth? And I don't know if the reason people don't understand that this is an unprecedented length of time be at war. Maybe it's just because we're still watching Nazi U-boat movies on TNT or something, and so we actually think that war is still going. I don't know what it is that has hardened us to the idea that we could have brought down Hitler three times by now. And
you know, I'm sorry.
I think that's very important to get clear that I'll say this one thing, and then I'll turn it back to you, Alberto. He talked about a non-militaristic future. You know, an economy he didn't use these words, I'm paraphrasing, but he talked about our economy has to be based on something besides war. And we know these wars had huge economic foundations. And even though we know it now, we're still having trouble getting out of them. So back to you, Edgar.
Yeah, I just read, I must confess that I don't do a whole lot about reading things like the Federalist Papers, but I was, two professors urged me to go ahead and start reading them. So today yesterday I read Federalist Paper number 10, and I was kind of forced into going to the college for a class this morning on it. And I'm writing a blog on this and writing that I want to put out there, but it is amazing how so much of what is happening right now has a lot to do with what's in Federalist Paper 10 and how we were actually structured and how we were designed to be factionalized that has all what we're seeing now in effect. It is going to be, it is just amazing. So for those that are listening, just take a glance at Federalist Paper 10. It is hard to understand the core of it, but it is something worth reading.
Absolutely. So I just scrolled down to the bottom of my screen, and I can see that there's someone down there who's been there for a while. Jack, we have about 2 minutes of free time, but I'm going to open your mic now. And I'm sorry,
Hello.
You were off my screen. Hey, Jack. What was your reaction to the State of the Union address?
Okay. It didn't mention that, I was impressed with the fact that Boehner applauded quite a bit. And he said some things. He did not criticize, he mentioned the Tea Party, he did not mention, Koch brothers. They mentioned the obstructionists. The power thing that's still going on. But I think that Democrats are going to I'm encouraged the fact that I don't think there's going to be any obstructionists on the debt ceiling. That's what I heard on the news this morning. I'm pretty much impressed because he did mention even tax reform. He mentioned the stuff I like to hear about. He didn't crap about New Jersey thing. Okay, I think I can make a comment about if I still think Christie's the strongest Republican candidate. But he's screwed up being a dictator, yeah.
Well, I got to ask you, I thought about you during the speech, Jack, because I know that you're a fan of no labels, and there was 40 people at the speech who had their little orange buttons on, and are they called problem solver buttons? And it's they're orange problem solver buttons that say committed to fix, not fight, no labels. And so when I saw those buttons and those people, Jack, I thought of you because you're the one who brings no labels into our conversation from time to time. So with that, I'm going to I have some housekeeping to do. Thanks a lot, as always, for calling in, Jack. There's a couple of things that I don't get to get out of here without sharing with people. And frankly, I'm saving the best for last, right? And that is that Coffee Talk Radio on Blog Talk Radio has 4 shows. We've got a few of them represented here today, but let me go through them. Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. Progressive Politics Tennessee Style with Bud Fields, Mondays, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson. Thursdays, of course, here you are, Lunch with Loudon, noon on the Pacific Shore, and 3 p.m. Eastern Time. I guess it's coffee break with Loudon and East. And Saturdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis, who just gave us his fine commentary on the City Union Address. Coffee Party. Coffee Party USA is a totally grassroots, crowdsourced, funded organization. Citizens United has not benefited us. No sugar daddies either. Although, you know, if you're interested in being a sugar daddy for Coffee Party, give me a call. If you'd like to become a member, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com. Find the big red member button. You can become a member, which gives you voting privileges, and the board will, time to time, query the membership specifically and only about certain items. Or you could just donate money, and there's a big donate button as well. Either way you go, whether you're a volunteer, a donor, a member, or a listener in our Be the Media project, the Consumer Be the Media, thanks. Thanks for taking part. So I'm going to give a last-minute shout-out to Ms. Debbie Lynn Molyneux. And can you just... after conversation and after what's going on in chat, where are you left?
Well, I am hopeful. I've been having fun talking with Viz and Bob and Joe over in the chat room. So thanks, guys, for making it so fun today. And you know, I'm hopeful. I like a lot of what Eric was sharing. Egberto, you might even inspire me to read the Federalist Papers, because that's something that I haven't done yet, and get back into the historical roots of our country. I know Biz is saying that he's read some of them as well. So, you know, the country is going to be just fine. It's just a matter of how comfortable or uncomfortable are we going to be when we get there. So I'm leaving more hopeful today, and I really enjoyed this show.
And I'm hopeful as well, because even in the face of criticism, so far we've had constructive criticism and civil criticism, and that's always encouraging to me. I think it's really important that we know that this is a safe place to talk, and I thought Egberto's mic was open. Egberto, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, I came to the show late, Janine, but thank you very much for, first of all, giving me a chance to say a few words. And I enjoyed everything that I heard. And I'd like to remind us to ask all our members as they listen to the podcast to share it on both their personal pages or whenever they go to any other place that has a subject germane to what we're speaking about, because that is how we are really going to be the media, by getting our words out, not only in the people that listen to it live or are accustomed to doing it through the podcast, but actually go out there and share it. It's all about sharing our information.
Thanks,
thank you, Janine.
Thanks. I agree completely. I think it's important to share this information, to share your input, to share it with a big post from yourself saying how this all went for you, how the speech went for you, how the show went for you. And now I'm opening Eric Weiler's mic. I have just a few seconds if you'd like to have closing remarks, Eric.
How many seconds?
Quite a minute. I have a minute.
Okay. I just want to say that...
Take all the time you want.
On Monday, the funniest thing was when you said that somebody is driving unsafely and nearly collides with you. All you have to do is shake your finger at them, and they suddenly feel like they were scolded by their grandmother because your hair turned gray. That was super funny.
You know, it's super true. I've learned that a little shake of the index finger does more good than shaking any other finger you could possibly think about.
That's great. Well, I'm starting to get some gray, but, you know, that's the first good thing I've ever heard about that.
It's amazing. Well, I'm not shaking my finger at you. I'm waving, saying goodbye, and thank you very much for your contribution to the show today. To everyone in chat, everyone listening, listening live or streaming later, thank you for being a part of the conversation. Coffee Party on.